Hello, this time on SITREP.
All allies are united in understanding that we need to step up to stay safe.
With the UK at the forefront, NATO allies have agreed a new defence investment pledge, raising defence and security spending to 5% of GDP by 2035.
It will add more than $1 trillion a year. And they said, you did it, sir, you did it. Well, I don't know if I did it, but I think I did.
We've got a lot to unpack from the NATO summit, haven't we? A lot of money promised, yes, but how will it be used for our defence? A former head of the British-led Allied Rapid Reaction Corps will help us read between the lines. We'll also break down the UK's decision bringing back the capability to drop nuclear bombs from planes. And Sian was in the room for some of the big moments. She'll give us the insider's guide to what it was like and what we might have missed.
SITREP with Kate Chabot and Professor Michael Clark.
So NATO summits are a big deal. Last year's summit's declaration came in at 38 paragraphs. This time, it was just 5 paragraphs long. And the one new thing, allies promised to increase their defence spending to at least 3.5% of national income within a decade from the current 2%, plus up to 1.5% on related security expenditure, which could include things like roads and communication networks. Mike, can such a short list of results still be a big deal?
Yes, it can. I mean, we would normally expect a NATO summit to deal with lots of different issues, all sorts of things about China and about new warfare and AI and cybersecurity, all those sort of things. This was a one-item agenda. I noticed that Ed Lucas this morning in The Times said it was a Potemkin summit. It was just a series of illusions. It was cowardly, he said. Well, I understand what he means, but actually they only had one issue to deal with, which was getting through it without an obvious bust-up with the United States, particularly with President Trump. And the essence of doing that was to concentrate on expenditure. So in that respect, it was successful. But my goodness, there's an awful lot of issues still to be addressed.
Yes, and those promised increases in defence spending are certainly significant. But it's not money that keeps us safe. It's what it's spent on and the capability that it delivers which matters. And they haven't said much about that, but we'll do our best to fill in the blanks. To help us is Sian Grescek-Melbourne. She joins us from The Hague, where she's been covering the summit for BFBS Forces News. Sian, it's been quite a whirlwind, I imagine.
Yes, Kate, and I wish someone had been filming the hundreds of journalists as we covered it, Gogglebox style, as we reacted to all the twists and turns, and there were so many. On a personal level, I would have loved to have seen the look on my face when Jerry, the Belgian Malinois explosives dog, who was checking all of our camera kits and our bags, decided to stop at mine, but thankfully it was just his half-time break.
Okay, interesting thought. Well, we also welcome Lieutenant General Sir Nick Boughton with his insights on the military workings of NATO from his 3 years commanding the Allied Rapid Reaction Corps until last year. Nick, great to see you on SITREP. Thank you very much for joining us. What's it like now as a former senior officer watching these political leaders making pronouncements and decisions on the world stage that your successors are now having to deliver on?
Well, it's certainly momentous times for NATO, but rather, as Michael said, I think the fact that the summit went so smoothly should be taken as a win. And to put it in context, if you think back to February of this year at the Munich Security Conference, where Europe got a lecture from the Vice President of the United States, we got a clear message from the Trump administration that they thought NATO was a protection racket, and President Trump expressed concerns about whether he really thought they should be in at all. We went into this summit extremely nervous, and I think the result of it can be taken as an absolute win. There is only one issue, really, which is funding, freeing up correct amount of money to spend the capability we need to achieve the deterrence that NATO is there to achieve. So I think Mark Rutte's played actually a very clever hand, and we've gone from being nervous about whether a couple of weeks ago whether Trump would even bother to turn up for the summit, and if he did, whether he would blow it up like a previous one, cause trouble and undermine the alliance. And what we've got is an agreement from almost all allies for 5%. And we've got President Trump saying that he subscribes to Article 5. If he didn't believe in it, he wouldn't be there. And that is, I think, a tremendous win from where we were at the beginning of the year. So I think NATO should be well pleased with itself.
Okay, so let's try and break down what the money will mean at the sharp end of defence. Mike, when Secretary General Mark Rutte says it will fuel a quantum leap for a stronger, fairer and more lethal NATO, is that oversell or will it really transform alliance capability?
Well, it shouldn't be an oversell because the alliance knows what it's got to do, and there'll be a new set of MCRs, minimum capability requirements, as a result of this. They're coming through now, and this lays down, as General Nick will know, I mean, exactly what all of the allies are supposed to be able to do, and they've got to be realistic. So the first thing that these extra spending pledges will need to go into is filling in the holes and actually making these force promises a reality so that there really is proper force there. But as well as doing that, this expenditure increase over the next decade has really got to transform NATO forces. The British are on that road. I think we're probably planning to go further down that road more quickly than just about anybody else in European NATO. And so in that respect, you know, we're acting as the experiment, really. But this, what we're trying to do is what all NATO forces are going to have to do over a decade. So they've got to spend this money really carefully and wisely. They've got to fill in the holes. And then they've got to transform themselves. And that will still mean some very difficult choices, some very difficult trade-offs. This is not going to be a gravy train for traditional militaries to keep on spending the way they were.
Nick, I saw you nodding away there. Do you want to add to that?
Yes, Michael's absolutely right. Percentages of GDP do not win battles and wars. You've got to take that money and decide what the future war you're going to fight looks like. Best guess as you possibly can, noting, you, as somebody famously once said, you almost certainly get it wrong. The trick's not to get it too wrong. And then actually get on with unlocking some of the bureaucratic hurdles and international defence trade hurdles to spending that money. There is a really live conversation going on in military circles, not least in NATO, about what the future nature of war looks like, largely informed by Ukraine, but also accepting that any future war that, God forbid, we may have to fight in NATO won't look exactly like that. So, as Michael says, clever decisions have got to be made, but decisions have to be made and you have to plump for the best decision you can. And there's a large element of future technology, of AI-driven, data-enabled systems and space-based systems versus traditional heavy metal conventional systems, that's a live debate that governments will have to close with as they start to spend this money.
And Kate, I mean, as often happens, I think, if General Nick would agree with me, I think the British are conceptually ahead on this. I think conceptually we're out in front. But as always, we're good at thinking it through. We're not always good at doing it. We're not always good at implementing it. But conceptually, we are in the lead on this, if only we can follow it through properly.
Absolutely right, yeah. And I think SDR lays that out very clearly, and you know, some people have been very rude about SDR, saying it's not funded and it's not a strategy. Well, that wasn't the aim. It was an external review to look at defence, say what was wrong and say how we should go forward. And I think if one reads SDR, it's actually a very well written and very shrewd observation of the future challenges that UK faces as part of the NATO alliance and what we should do about it. It's now the government's job, having accepted the 52 recommendations of the SDR, in order to work out how to do that. So turning the idea or the policy into an actual strategy. But the SDR in itself, as Michael Riley says, is, it, you know, very, very good thinking, and the British are good at this.
Sean, before the summit, Mark Rutte pointed to recently agreed capability targets as the high stakes homework that informs this defence investment plan. Were you able to get any detail there about what capability targets the UK has agreed to?
Well, the short answer to that is no, not really. I mean, as Mike just said, this was very much a one item agenda summit. But the one thing we did get, of course, was the UK releasing their headline about the purchase of 12 F-35A jets, which we'll talk about in more detail later, which is that first insight we have, I think. I think they wanted this summit to be all about those initial headlines, as Mike said, and also what Nick said there as well about just the achievement of that in itself being a huge win. And one of the things that really stood out for me was talking to lots of Dutch journalists and them having lots of praise for Rutte behind the scenes and sort of harkening back to when he was prime minister, saying, you know, they described him as Teflon, but also a very smooth operator. Mm. And we saw how Trump was invited to the palace, you know, all of that, that work to actually get, you know, this result probably shouldn't be underestimated. But what really surprised me post the F-35 announcement from the UK is when we were all waiting for the NATO leaders to walk by the press, you know, early doors. They normally will make a statement. Most of them will take questions. When Keir Starmer walked in, he kept walking, sort of hanging his body away from us. And the Dutch reporter standing next to me really wasn't very impressed. And he said, really? He has nothing to say.
It's probably what he didn't want to say about politics at home, I'm sure. So to an extent, we're left making educated guesses, Nick. What's your sense of what NATO wants the UK to focus on in capability for the alliance?
So that those things are not the subject of guesswork, and it's a slightly geeky point that's not well appreciated, but the strategic planning staff in NATO headquarters in Brussels have a whole team dedicated to working out what these requirements are and allocating them across allies on a sort of routinely cyclical basis called the NATO Defence Planning Process. So the 3.5%, which I think is sometimes viewed in the press as a sort of arbitrary figure that somebody's plucked out of thin air, could be 3.7, could be 2, could be 5, add a 1.5 in for infrastructure. The 3.5 of hard military capability is based on the actual analysis of the military staff on the regional plans that have been designed by General Cavoli with all of us in the staffs below him. So we have a warfighting plan for each of the regions in NATO now. We have forces allocated to it. We know what capabilities are required to deliver all of those plans. And then those are allocated to nations by size. And therefore, you know, there's a fair bit of science that underpins the 3.5 and how we rebuild the capability. Of course, the question is, how quickly you do it and over what time frame versus what time frame you think the Russians are going to rearm and be in a position to threaten the alliance. So, you know, we're all pretty clear on what's required. And what you see, as Sian rightly says, is some of those headlines coming out about fighter jets and integrated air and missile defence increasing by 400%, which is, you know, clearly one of the areas where we have been lax.
So, Nick, what is required from the UK?
Well, what we've signed up to in the SDR, which again is what's down in the MCRs for NATO, is a fully enabled core headquarters, the Allied Rapid Reaction Corps, with now two British divisions underneath it. So we have a third UK division, which was used to be known as the Warfighting Division, on the assumption there was only one. But we have, of course, got a second division, the First Division, and the Army now have to bring that back up to war fighting capability. And the theory is that both British divisions will be under the arc. And then there'll be a set number of fighter or multi-role aircraft squadrons under the Royal Air Force, and then a set number of maritime task groups. I think, you know, as Michael said earlier, we do punch above our weight and we don't always get credit for that. So we have got two state-of-the-art aircraft carriers. And the other thing we bring to the party is the only European nuclear deterrent actually declared to NATO. And that's very significant. And traditionally, we didn't always get credit for those additional things, which is now much more acknowledged. So the whole thing is a certain amount of trading goes on. But we're now clear from the SDR and the work that's done in NATO and now the funding agreed and the summit about how we get to those points. But no one is pretending those things are easy.
Yeah, and to that point, Mike, inevitably some people say it's easy to promise. Can we and others deliver?
Well, we certainly intend to. I mean, this is the point that Richard Barons has made, you know, to us on Sitrep. He said, look, it's there. All we've got to do now is just get on with it. Instead of, you know, he said he didn't want to hear from people saying, well, we've heard this before with all these promises, the government never delivers. He said, forget all that. Just do it. Just do it if we're serious about it. And I think the mood has changed. My fear about all of this. I mean, you know, we say with the whole SDR design, you know, one is the funding going to be there? Well, yes, it is. Is the implementation possible? You know, can we do it? Can we actually get on and do it? I think yes, we can. The third issue is the one that we haven't really talked about. Has the public signed up to this? Yeah. Is the public on board for a real change, as we saw with the National Security Strategy published this week, for the reality that we may now have to face the prospect of war? actual war. So is the public on board for this? Because that's where the trade-offs will really hurt. That's where we will have to make some sacrifices with a sense that we know why we're sacrificing whatever it is we sacrifice in favour of our national defence. And that's the one that worries me most, because we haven't engaged. And to be fair, or to be honest, I don't think Downing Street is facing that at the moment. All of the mood music from Downing Street is not to talk about this too much. You know, we've got them out there. We've talked about it to the policy community. We've made our statements to the press, but they don't seem to want to get out and argue for it. And I hope that changes in the months to come over the summer.
We shall see. Let's dig a little further now into one specific capability announcement that the UK made at the summit. The decision to buy 12 A variants of the F-35 fighter jet, which, as we discussed just a couple of weeks ago, would be capable of carrying nuclear bombs. Rather than explaining the thinking, let's hear the Defence Secretary doing it in his own words.
This is a recognition, as our Strategic Defence Review said when we published it 3 weeks ago, that we're facing increasing threats, we're facing rising nuclear risks, and it recommended that we looked at buying this new type of jet. It recommended also that the UK considered playing a part in the established NATO nuclear mission. So that's what, 3 weeks on, we're announcing that we will do. We'll buy these jets. They'll allow us to train, do regular fast jet training. They'll do all the sort of combat missions for regular conventional fifth generation fast jets. But they'll also be capable in extreme circumstances of being able to participate in the nuclear mission for NATO. And by doing that, we're reinforcing the deterrence that NATO can provide. This is not the UK taking on and having a new UK nuclear weapon. It's playing a part in an established programme that carries US weapons in extreme circumstances. And it complements the continuing independent sovereign NATO deterrent that we run from some of our submarines, and that has been our ultimate guarantor of security and the ultimate deterrent for us and for NATO allies for decades now.
So, Nick, how big a deal do you think this is?
I think it's certainly significant, and it's indicative of how serious the government is taking the threat and particularly the role of nuclear weapons in the whole scale of deterrence. It's not obviously the only thing we want to rely on, because it's somewhat all or nothing. You know, and we ought to come back to how you fill the middle bit as well without dodging the issue. But nonetheless, it is significant. But of course, again, it sounds like UK's joining the nuclear sharing agreement for the first time and entering the nuclear regime. And that agreement is a slightly technical thing involving aircraft delivered weapons that we haven't been involved in for a little while. We shouldn't forget, as John Healy just touched on there, that for over 60 years, we've delivered a continuous at-sea deterrent, which is a nuclear deterrent sovereign and declared to NATO, unlike the French one. So other than the US, the Brits are the only people who declare an independent nuclear deterrent to NATO all the time. So at the end of the day, it's about the effect at the other end, not how you deliver it. So there'll be a lot of excitement over those jets, extremely capable aircraft. And it's good news we're getting 12 A variants who don't just have to be used for the nuclear role. They're very capable in their own right. But it is, you know, set against the context of our ongoing commitment to nuclear deterrence as part of the range of deterrence that NATO provides.
So, Mike, why Britain, when plenty of other European NATO allies already have planes that can drop nuclear bombs?
That's a very good point, Kate, because this decision is not without its critics, even within the military, who say, look, this is a political act, that we don't really need to do this. I mean, we used to, you know, we used to have the Tornadoes deliver the WE-177 bomb, and we stopped that. We gave that up in 1998 with the Strategic Defence Review at the end of the Cold War. And the allies that are presently in this business of air-delivered weapons still are, you know, Germany, Italy, Belgium, Netherlands, of course, the United States, France does it independently as well. So there's half a dozen allies who do it. Greece and Turkey used to, but they gave that up in the early 2000s, although they're pretty cagey about when it actually came to an end. And what some say is, look, we're going in for a pretty expensive capability here, expensive aircraft, although, as Nick said, you know, they're dual capable, so they don't have to only be used in this role. But nevertheless, we're going in for an expensive capability, and we don't really need to do it. We're doing it for political reasons, to show that we're part of every aspect of NATO. And I can see that argument, but this is not without its critics, who say that that money should go on some of the other more urgent needs on transformational forces. We don't really need to do this because our continuous at-sea deterrent is our contribution to nuclear deterrence in NATO, and there's plenty of tactical nuclear deterrence already existing in those other states that I mentioned.
And Sean, these F-35As will fly from RAF Marham, where we already have F-35B jets. How do the planes actually compare? Will the RAF be happy to have the A variant for conventional use?
Well, the Chief of the Air Staff was very quick to put out a statement yesterday calling it a profound step for UK defence. He described it as demonstrating an unshakable commitment to NATO. Now, comparing what we have at the moment, the F-35B, it has a short takeoff vertical landing capability, very impressive if you're watching that live. But it's not cleared, of course, to carry nuclear weapons. Neither is the conventional carrier landing C model used by the US Navy. And the F-35A is the only variant of the Lightning that is currently cleared for NATO nuclear munitions, as we know. And just coming back to General Sir Richard Barons, one of the authors of the Strategic Defence Review, you know, he said he thought that it would be a good idea to get them because of its dual capability. You know, it can do the conventional role and it can also carry the American freefall nuclear munition.
Mike, one of the things you mentioned last week talking to Greg Bagwell was about refuelling, and he pointed out the F-35A cannot be refuelled by the RAF Voyager. On X, he has posted saying we can still get refuelling from NATO's allies tankers, and maybe there is a technical solution down the line. But then, you know, among the critics, John Foreman, another friend of SITREP, a former military attaché to Moscow and Kyiv, calling it a total waste of money and the stupidest decision by our government in living memory.
Yes.
I mean, he doesn't mince his words, does he, John? Is the government going to get much pushback, do you think?
Yeah, John is never knowingly understated. No, I mean, there will be some pushback on this, but I don't think the money is an issue. I mean, the point is the next tranche of F-35s we get will be the A variant instead of the B variant. So it's within the envelope of spending on the F-35, the 138 that we are mythically supposed to get eventually, but none of us believe we'll ever get 138. But as we get each tranche, if the next tranche are A variants, then that will be, and we're going to switch to a mixed force of A's and B's, then that makes perfect sense. I don't think finance is so much of an issue. But the tanker issue is an interesting little conundrum. And it's all to do with booms and hoses, as we discussed last week.
So, yes.
You know, the United States is designed to refuel with booms, and we designed to refuel with nice flexi hoses. And as Richard Barron's thing said, there's got to be a technical solution to that. But in the meantime, yes, I mean, if you want to be critical of the whole decision, you'd say, well, here we are. I mean, British nuclear tactical aircraft with tactical nuclear weapons on board will need to be refueled by NATO tankers, not even our own sovereign capability. I'm sure that by the time these things are in full operation, end of the decade, we'll have worked out the difference between booms and hoses.
Indeed, I hope so. Nick, the other point here is it's a slightly odd look when NATO's biggest member has just bombed Iran to prevent it from acquiring nuclear weapons.
Well, I think that therein lies the theory of the non-proliferation treaty, and you know, the theory ever since, you know, the 50s when these weapons first came on the scene. In a meaningful number, that they were utterly devastating. They were the means by which we prevented war between the two superpowers, as was, but they were controlled very tightly within large national systems with disciplined militaries who had de-escalation measures, who had communications, who had a rules of the game that could be trusted on, an intense diplomatic framework around it to prevent there being a disaster. And they were very effective. But at the same time, it was recognised that just allowing that a weapon technology to be proliferated and in its worst case to terrorist or non-state actors was a bad thing. And I guess, you know, if you own the game, you make the rules, and therefore we, you know, the Americans and the Russians agreed that proliferation shouldn't be expanded. And so I think they're two different things. And we would say, you know, we have these weapons in order to ensure peace in Europe, and they've worked for, you know, upwards of 75 years. I think we would also recognise that Iran is, you know, on record. This isn't, you know, some radical outside view by Bolton. You know, Iran is on record as one of the largest state sponsors of terrorism around the world, responsible for the death of certainly dozens of British service people, as well as many other people. So the idea of them having a nuclear weapon strikes me as rather a bad idea. So I think on this rare occasion, I was rather with the Americans on this one.
And since we mentioned Iran and the US bombing, we should probably talk now about the star of the show. He dropped the F-bomb on his way to the summit and spent quite a bit of airtime rejecting reports that his actual bombing had done significantly less damage to Iran's nuclear program than he claimed. Sean, you were in the room for Donald Trump's news conference, you lucky person. That must have been quite the experience.
It was. It was quite a long press conference when it eventually started, about 40 minutes. I managed to get on the third row by staying in play after the Mark Rutter press conference. However, a lot of us very nearly lost our spaces when they tried to just clear the first three rows for the American press. But some of us held our nerve and row three thankfully survived. And when it started, it was quite a journey, as it always is. I mean, he started by saying how beautiful the Netherlands was, especially the trees, that he might be taking one of the trees home with him. He was, of course, flanked by Pete Hegseth and Marco Rubio. And at one point, he said he might change Hegseth's title back to Secretary of War. He compared the strikes on Iran to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, saying they were responsible for ending the war between Iran and Israel, he said, in a slightly different way. He was getting increasingly angry. And you mentioned those intelligence reports there about the strikes not being as successful as planned. And
yeah,
he and Hegseth really stuck it to the outlets running those lines, and they effectively said that was an attack on the brave pilots and personnel involved in carrying them out. He also said he would negotiate personally with Spain directly over their spending, trying to get them up to that baseline of 3.5 and 5%. He was clearly very happy, though, hailing the summit as a great victory and saying that NATO is not a ripoff. And earlier, when Rutter was being asked about his stance on charming Trump and how he was calling him the daddy and heaping praise on him, Rutter's response to that was, doesn't he deserve the praise? If he wasn't president, would we be here making this spending announcement now? I feel like a lot happened in that press conference, but of course everyone just wanted to ask him his latest definition of Article 5, because of course before he got on the plane, or when he was on the plane, he had said, oh, there are many definitions. And as Mike mentioned earlier, he eventually said, if I didn't stand with it, I wouldn't be here.
Mike, we've seen President Trump almost completely derail a NATO summit back in 2018 in Brussels. Will there be a big sigh of relief today from the Secretary General and the other leaders?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I mean, because they got through it, and it will be regarded as a success. And I mean, Mark Rutter, you know, using the daddy word, will hang on him for the rest of his time as Secretary General. And this morning, the White House put out a meme, a very, very funny meme, with a big sign saying, "Daddy's home." I mean, this will run and run. Believe me, daddy. And Trump will love that. He'll absolutely love it. So, yes, the summit played to that. And something else Sean said is really important. I mean, Trump said, I will personally take charge of negotiations with Spain over its contribution. And he said, and we'll adjust it through tariffs. Now, tariffs have got nothing to do with NATO, and tariffs are for discussion with the EU. But Trump doesn't see it that way. So for him, if a nation doesn't make its contribution, if it doesn't join the club now, then he'll punish it even more. He said, we'll double the tariffs. And that's exactly the way Trump thinks. Again, he's the businessman. He's not a politician as such. And so he thinks of what sort of levers have I got that I can pull? How can I squeeze the Spanish more to take a different decision on their expenditure to NATO? And then there was one final thing that I thought was really telling. At the dinner last night, I mean, this is a 2.5 hour summit. You know, 32 nations have come together to meet for 2.5 hours. You know, the expense of all of that, which is just to get through it. And at the dinner, Trump was sat next to the King of the Netherlands on one side and Giorgia Meloni on the other. That's a subtle decision because he likes her. You know, she actually is quite close to him politically. And she's got a sort of flirty glint in her eye when she talks to him. And he really responds to that. And I thought that's a subtle decision. A king on one side and Giorgia on the other. That makes for a successful dinner when you've got Trump in the room.
And the cost was €183 million.
Golly. Nick, now you're out of uniform, you can be as candid or remain quite as discreet as you want. It's up to you. I just want to wonder how people doing the jobs at the sharp end feel when they see the behaviour of not just Donald Trump, but other political leaders at really important events like this.
Well, I think the great thing about people in uniform is they just get on with a job and do the job they get paid to do. I think we're all getting used to the circus of political life. I think with regard to the Trump administration, particularly, I go back to what I said earlier, which is, you know, I think Rutte, you know, he'll get a lot of criticism for it, but he's played Trump brilliantly. And we are where we are in a much better position as a result. So well done him. And as Michael says, you know, you have to play Trump in a particular way. So royalty and particular prime ministers who he may favour. Great, flatter him. And we got what we wanted. We're in a much better position. I think there is also an element of, you know, and I take comfort from this. I was in shape in Mons last week talking to commanders and officials. And, you know, it's important to differentiate between the Trump White House and the cold-hearted application of military power and diplomacy and policy by serious, educated, intelligent, committed, pro-NATO, pro-European American officials. NATO is still being run absolutely firmly by General Cavoli and a number of superbly talented US officers, along with all of the other European allies alongside them, including not least ourselves. So it's important to differentiate between the two. And as one American official said to me a few months ago, don't join the dots when you hear these announcements from the Trump White House, when you hear the F-bomb, when you hear one view about we're not bombing, it's their problem, oh, we're bombing, or whatever it might be. She said, you're all joining the dots like you do with your own politicians, making up as they go along. So don't join the dots, just see what the outcomes of the policy are and hold your nerve.
Really important to remember that. And Sean, Ukraine's President Zelensky was also there. He didn't seem to get much of a look in, though, at least a view from here.
Well, I mean, he did meet with President Trump. Wouldn't you have loved to have been a fly on the wall for that meeting? In his press conference, President Trump said, you know, he couldn't have been nicer. Of course, a huge contrast to that very public falling out at the White House. He was on the official programme on day one, President Zelensky, but the scale, you know, was much smaller, a smaller room for journalists to hear his statement afterwards. I was quite struck by the unsurprising contrast of how fresh-faced Rutte and Ursula von der Leyen looked to how exhausted President Zelensky looks. And they were saying all of the encouraging things that you would expect them to say. He was, of course, there at the palace for the state dinner with the King and Queen. And Mark Rutte was quick to highlight that when he was asked about, you know, the amount of time that he got during this summit. But coming back to that press conference with President Trump, a Ukrainian journalist asked him if the US is ready to sell Patriot missiles to Ukraine. And his answer was, we're going to see if we can make some available. But then he sort of started to interview her. And you could see that he was, you know, almost visibly moved by her story when she said her husband was a soldier in Ukraine. So even though he didn't get as much attention, perhaps, as he obviously did this time last year, it was still woven throughout the summit in very interesting ways.
Nick, when you look at the prominence of Ukraine compared to previous summits, really the issue does seem to have been marginalised. How much of a worry is that to you?
I don't think it's a worry at all. I mean, we came to this summit because we all understand the context and we understand the world we live in, and we've got to fix it. And the way we've got to fix it is to stump up enough money to keep ourselves safe, and so focus on the main effort. And that's what they did. The last summit in Washington, as you rightly said, stated very clearly on numerous occasions support for Ukraine, the EU have stated that, all of our European leaders have stated that. What's the merit in going to Brussels and wasting time going on about how we all support Ukraine again? We've got that, so let's use the limited time available to focus on the main effort, which is unleashing the money to keep the rest of the alliance free while we keep Ukraine in the fight. And the key thing there is, in whichever way the war in Ukraine ends, for good or for ill, and we don't know how that's going to happen, and it certainly hasn't happened as swiftly as President Trump pronounced that it would do, but it will end at some point. The future security architecture of Europe will be changed for a generation, and 1.5 million Russian soldiers will no longer be engaged in combat in Ukraine and will be available to move to anywhere else along the border with NATO. And so we have got a period of time in which to get ourselves sorted out in order to meet that potential threat in the future. And the summit was the opportunity to start a serious conversation about that by getting the money in place to start unlocking the bureaucracy and procuring the capability we need to keep us safe. So I don't think endless discussion about supporting Ukraine. Zelensky knows that we all support him. He gets that in spades. In fact, earlier this week on Monday, our Prime Minister announced another agreement with Ukraine about defence industrial development. So I think that message was loud and clear. I think they played it right.
And Sean, can I just pick up on a point that Mike made earlier about the need in the UK to get the public on board with the importance of defence and investing in it? What sense did you get about that in other European countries?
Well, I think there's such a huge contrast, and I'm so pleased that Mike brought that up, because I was having a conversation with a journalist who's based in the Netherlands, and she was saying that every month they have emergency sirens that go off. Everyone has a text on their phone on the first Monday of every month. The government have asked all citizens to have a 72-hour supply of food and water, and she was quoting a figure of about 42% of the public have done that. And you could only imagine, you know, the difference if that's what the UK public were being told. But there is so much work to be done, I think, because when you go to countries like the Netherlands, you know, like Estonia, the general feeling on the ground when you talk to the average citizen is that they very much do, you know, expect that this might potentially happen. And of course, you would expect that in places like Estonia and proximity to Russia. But it's very evident that, you know, even in the Netherlands, they're like, OK, this actually might happen. And we really don't get the sense, do we, in the UK that the penny has dropped?
Yes. Interesting. Nick, you were nodding there. Do you think we should be a bit more on it in the UK in terms of making people aware about the possibility of war?
Yeah, and I think that's what the national security strategy linked to the defence review says very clearly. And I spend a fair bit of time in my NATO role in the Nordics and in the Baltics, and they're much closer to any future Russian threat, and they're very alive to it. And most of those countries have lived under Russian or Soviet occupation to some degree in their history, so that they take the whole thing much more seriously. There is a national conversation about defence that they're all committed to and involved in a way that perhaps we were during the 50s and 60s, but are no longer. And it's very interesting, as you open the news this morning, the NATO summit and the challenges that NATO faced completely off the news, and we're back to a fight about welfare spending. And that in itself indicates the conversation in this country. And as CGS said a few months ago, how is this not the most important thing that we're dealing with? Why is this not the most important thing that the government's funding? And I think they're doing their best, but certainly I don't think the message has landed nationally yet. And so that is a conversation that we need to have without a shadow of a doubt.
And Mike, a final thought from you. How do you think we'll be reflecting on this summit in 10 years' time, when everyone is supposed to be spending 5% of their national income on defence and security with transformed military capabilities?
Yeah, well, it's a long journey between now and 2035, when this will all be supposed to have happened. And I think we'll be in a different world by then, one way or another. And I think the key question for me with NATO is not, you know, can NATO survive these rows? It always does. I mean, we've had, you know, terrible rows in NATO over the years over France pulling out of NATO in 1966, and then the rows over the intermediate nuclear forces in the 1980s. And then all the row over Iraq in 2003. I mean, NATO always gets over these rows, but the reason it always gets over them is because there are very strong community of values and particularly transatlantic values. And that's the key question for me. It's the transatlantic values that we share with the United States and with the other new members of Europe. The values, that's the cement that holds all the bricks together. And I think we'll find out in 10 years' time if those values are still so commonly held. If they are, then NATO will be in pretty good shape, I think, with this money being spent, I hope well, by then. But if those values really are in decline, then the cement will have disappeared in 10 years' time, and NATO will be a fairly empty edifice. One way or another, we'll find out by then.
Okay, thank you, Mike. Lieutenant General Nick Boughton, thank you. And Sian Greshek-Melbourne, thank you to you. Safe journey home. And that is all for now. Professor Michael Clark will be joined by James Hurst for another SITREP next Thursday. In the meantime, you can stay up to date with all the latest defence news on our website, forcesnews.com. For now, though, from me, Kate Jabot, thank you for joining us. Bye-bye.